You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. You've seen it. I've seen it. We've all seen it. This is the 75th anniversary of the first great sports movie, The Pride of the Yankees. Our guest provides intriguing glimpses behind the movie that is a must-see for movie and baseball buffs alike. Richard Sandomir of the New York Times has meticulously researched and written the well-received The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic for Hache Books. And we welcome Richard to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Thanks so much. Let's start with this, Richard.
Sure.
Lou Gehrig almost didn't address the crowd. We almost didn't have a historical moment.
Well, yeah, he and his wife Eleanor had planned on him speaking in the event that he could speak. They had worked on some sort of speech, but if you watch what's left of the newsreel, he walked up there without anything in his hand, which leads me to believe that never really was a speech, just some thoughts that he and Eleanor had developed. So, remember the scene. It's between games of a doubleheader between the Yankees and the Senators on July 4th, 39. It's a hot day. He's not well. His body is withering underneath his flannel uniform, which is even baggier than the fashion was back then. And he has to wait through marching bands and speeches and gift giving. And at the end of it, he basically waves away the MC, Sid Mercer, and Mercer announces to the crowd, I will not ask him to speak. And then the chanting began, we want Lou, we want Lou. And finally he gave in, and he delivered a phenomenal speech with nothing in hand.
Whose idea was it to make this movie?
It was Samuel Goldwyn's idea, but it was done sort of quite reluctantly. His story editor for this film was Niven Busch. Niven Busch would, shortly after the movie came out, become married to Teresa Wright, who played Eleanor. And in 1929, he had done a profile of Lou for The New Yorker, in which he was very negative about Lou's personality, said basically, he doesn't even deserve a public, he's so dull. So in 1941, after Lou dies, Bush suggests to Goldwyn that he do a movie. And because Bush was a baseball fan, but Goldwyn had no idea what baseball was. He might not even have known who Lou Gehrig was up to that point. So he says, I'm not doing a baseball movie. Baseball is box office poison. You want to go see a game? Go to a ballpark. He might not even said ballpark. Bush didn't give in. He had the newsreels. He said, Goldwyn, just sit down in your screening room and I'll show them to you. And Goldwyn sat through them, and maybe he was fidgety as he watched the marching band and the speeches. But then he watches the speech, and the lights go up, and he's crying. He says, run them again. Ran them again, lights go up, and he ordered that a phone call be made to his number two guy, Jim Mulvey, in New York, told Mulvey, reach out to Eleanor Gehrig. So what I feel that Goldwyn certainly saw there was a courageous guy being very, very dignified in the face of death. By then, he knew that Gehrig had died. And then by the time he spent some time with Eleanor, he realized he had a love story. And that's what they made. They didn't make a baseball movie. They made a love story.
And it's ironic that it became a classic, Richard, given that the stars who played Lou and Eleanor Gehrig and Goldwyn himself knew pretty much nothing about baseball.
Yeah, well, fortunately, some of the screenwriters knew something about baseball. Paul Gallico, the first one, had been the sports editor and columnist for the Daily News. Herman Mankiewicz was a big baseball fan. Christy Walsh, who was Eleanor's agent and certainly one of the first agents of sports, worked for Babe, worked for Lou. He worked in part now and then on the script, but he knew baseball very well. But again, it wasn't a baseball movie. There were 10 or 12 minutes of baseball action there. Gary Cooper was taught how to play baseball in 6 weeks by Lefty O'Doul, the former National League Baseball champion, National League batting champion. And in making a movie that's really a love story and the story of a courageous guy, Cooper was really within his wheelhouse of playing men of quiet dignity. That's what he did. and he only had to be himself. He felt a little bit of pressure to play Gehrig and to be credible as a ball player. But in 1942, actors were not required to be as athletic as they would be now. I am certain that if you cast the part of the Yankees now, an actor without baseball skills would not be cast, and Cooper, an actor like Cooper, would not play Lou Gehrig now. But in 42, he was a big star, and this is what he did. He played himself.
And Samuel Golden didn't think much about movies that involved athletes. In point of fact, Richard, had there been, I would think, just a handful of movies made about athletes up until that time?
Well, and look, it was hardly a genre to speak of. A year before, Knute Rockne All-American was out, did okay. Ronald Reagan was George Gipp, and it was an okay movie, but there wasn't much. You know, there were some comedy sports movies. There were, The Champ with Wallace Beery and Jackie Cooper, but it really wasn't there. Marx Brothers doing their football satire in Horse Feathers. It just it wasn't what it is now. So there was not a lot of enthusiasm by other studios. MGM and David O. Selznick were interested, but they didn't make any strong bids. And it was only after seeing the newsreels that Goldwyn made his bid. So you could understand why there wasn't huge bidding for even as big a star with as dramatic a story as Gehrig, because baseball and sports were not much of a really weren't a genre at all.
How much time passed from Lou Gehrig's passing until shooting began?
Let's see, from early June to early February, so 8 months. But the real quick moves were made between Lou's death and the signing of the contract. That was barely 6 weeks.
Wow.
Eleanor reached out to Christy Walsh, and she needed his guidance. Not that she didn't want to have a movie made about Lou. She was the guardian of his legacy, and I don't know how much she understood a movie would preserve that legacy, but I'm sure with her heavy involvement in the movie, she was looking to preserve his image, and thus, 75 years later, the legacy has been preserved.
Richard Sandomir with us. He's written a fabulous new book called The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. How was it received by critics?
I'd say about 80% very positive. There was some criticism that there wasn't a whole lot of drama, and that may well be because people were expecting bottom-of-the-ninth home run heroics. The most dramatic baseball action in the movie is a fiction. It's whether Lou will be able to hit the second home run that he promised to the kid with polio in the hospital in St. Louis. Not a true thing, but that was it. Again, Goldwyn ordained this would not be a baseball movie. So the drama comes when Cooper delivers the speech at the end. That is it. And I know that Dan Daniel, the columnist in the New York papers, he was critical of the fact that the baseball action wasn't very good. So he was a little astute there, maybe a little ahead of the curve of other people. Maybe he was expecting something better. But back then there were actually small companies that are dedicated now to making sure sports action is credible and to training athletic actors to play sports. But can you imagine a Gary Cooper-like actor up against a Kevin Costner or a Chadwick Boseman? All these guys who Redford had a lovely swing in The Natural. All these actors played baseball pretty well, and you couldn't do that now. It wouldn't fly.
How much dramatic license overall was taken in the movie, and what, Richard, is apocryphal? Are there legends about the movie that, in fact, aren't true?
Well, at the point that Paul Gallico left the movie, because he was the first screenwriter and outline writer, he was asked by Golden, by contract, how much of this to put down how much of the movie was true. And there were three categories: things that were true, things that were based on something Eleanor told him, and three things that were totally made up. two-thirds fall into those last two categories. About one-third then was based on the truth. You know, Eleanor sent letters now and then during the filming to Goldwyn saying, well, you know, look at the script. This isn't right. This is wrong. This is wrong. You can't have Lou signed to his contract by Miller Huggins wearing a suit in a Yankee office. That wouldn't happen. You can't have Lou hitting four home runs in a World Series game. And she said, you know, it's all well and good. The script has Lou's parents attending our wedding, but they weren't there. And she lost on most of these things. She was very concerned that people who know baseball really, really well would look at a movie filled with all sorts of wrong notions about baseball and say, aha, look what Hollywood's doing to the sport. She was a fan of baseball. I'm sure she became even more of a fan and more knowledgeable once she married Lou. So here she was getting copies of the script and saying, you know, you can't do this. It's not right. Some of the things that she was correcting Gallico on were kind of comical, if only because Gallico should have known better than to have any of these things. So it was a there was a lot of dramatic license, although one story about dramatic license really wasn't much license at all. There was a debate between Goldwyn and the writers and Christy Walsh, among them, kind of defending the honor of Lou, about whether to put in a scene during his minor league sequences of him going off on a bender for like 2 weeks and, you know, thinking that drinking would help his hitting. It turns out he did go on a bender, according to Eleanor, and there was a debate about whether, you know, would it be more manly for him to show that here he's kind of a goody-goody mama's boy, let him, you know, let him get drunk on camera. You know, Goldwyn sort of said, well, I don't want my Garrick actor to be a sissy. And, you know, Walsh stood up and said, well, I don't drink and I'm not a sissy. So it is not in there. There's a coach character who follows Lou from the minor leagues to the Yankees, and I think he is portrayed as helping Lou out to the field to make the speech. The character's name is Frawley. He was named for William Frawley, the future Fred Mertz, who was a friend of Gallico's. So there was quite a bit of dramatic license. Surely Lou probably visited kids in hospitals and Babe did also, but he didn't hit home runs for a little kid. And you know, the character, the provenance of the little kid character in the hospital went back and forth. Was he a poor kid? Was he a kid whose background you don't know, which is what we saw in the movie, or was he a rich kid? And in the rich kid version, he was the child of the flirty Myra from the fraternity and her husband, who was Lou's taunter, Van. They got married in that version of the movie, and they were very wealthy. And indeed, there's a scene later in the movie where Lou visits them at their house, and it is there that he shows how badly the ALS had affected him. He's playing, he's playing ball with the kids, and he can't hit anything the kids are throwing at him. And there were several versions of that. But I think that if Goldwyn had even looked at those seriously, he would have said, no, just the subtlety of him clutching his shoulder while he's play wrestling with Eleanor is enough. We don't have to go very far.
It is remarkable, Richard, to see Babe Ruth and his Yankee teammates in this movie, but you write that Eleanor Gehrig didn't want Babe Ruth in the movie.
No, she was not a fan of his. She felt, at the very least, that Lou had played in the shadow for a decade, played in Babe's shadow for a decade, only got out of it after Babe left for Boston in 35. And she didn't want Babe to overshadow Cooper in the movie. And then, of course, there were rumors about whether Lou was upset with the Babe because he thought that his wife may have had an affair with Babe on a boat trip to Tokyo. Or there was a story about whether Mother Gehrig had insulted Claire Ruth over the way she dressed one of her daughters. Be that as it may, they didn't have much of a relationship for the last few years of Lou's life, and it didn't really become a great relationship again after Babe hugged Lou on the Luckiest Day, Luckiest Man speech day. So Eleanor was concerned that Babe would steal the spotlight, and maybe what she didn't realize, or maybe what she had to eventually acknowledge, is that Goldwyn needed some sense of verisimilitude with baseball. And if Babe, even at 47, couldn't hit home runs the way he used to, he still had to swing. So you'd see him occasionally, and he could still swing like Babe Ruth, and that was not a problem for him. And she also had to realize that Babe knew how to play Babe pretty well. He'd been in some silent movies. He was always mugging for newsreel cameras. And if you look at what he had done in the past, he was pretty good at being the Babe. And Eleanor also said, well, you know, maybe we just never have him do a solo scene. And there would have been no reason for him to do solo scenes. So she didn't win that one, but the movie was victorious because Babe was basically the third star of the movie after Cooper and Teresa Wright. Walter Brennan, you know, was probably the co-third person. But if fans felt that there was – if baseball fans wanted to go and wanted a hook, maybe it was Ruth. And by then, if Goldwyn didn't realize – all this before filming began, he certainly realized realized how big a deal Babe was.
On the 75th anniversary of the Pride of the Yankees, we're speaking with Richard Sandomir, who's written a terrific new book about the movie entitled The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. And to Gary Cooper for a moment, Richard, he got the title role over some very formidable names in Hollywood, including Eddie Albert, Pat O'Brien, Cary Grant, Fred McMurray, Spencer Tracy, and Gary Cooper, we learn in your book, was Eleanor Gehrig's favorite actor.
Well, yeah, and the fact that Cooper got the role was no surprise to anybody except for those who believed in the publicity stunt that Goldwyn was pulling by having the Sporting News, Cosmopolitan, and the Gallup organization poll fans as to see who they think should play Gehrig. The fact is that it was an idea that it appears to have been hatched by the gossip queen Luella Parsons, who said to Goldwyn, why don't you have a Scarlett O'Hara-like search for who would play Gehrig? But Cooper was in the last picture of his contract with Goldwyn. He was precisely the right kind of actor to play the kind of character that Gehrig was. So while Goldwyn got a lot of publicity for all these other actors being thought of, even ballplayers, even Babe Ruth was thought of by some fans as a possibility to play Gehrig.
Wow.
As were Wally Pipp and Babe Dahlgren, Lou's predecessor and successor at first base. I can't believe it was anything but publicity. And even in a letter between Eleanor and Christy Walsh, Christy was kind of laughing at the whole thing. And Christy participated in it. During the World Series, he passed around a press release saying, who's going to play Lou Gehrig? But it seems very clear that this was just to get publicity. But the fact is, I think almost everybody who took the movie seriously, fans and insiders alike, they must have known that Cary Grant was not going to be playing Lou Gehrig, not with that accent. I mean, he was athletic. He was an acrobat. But to me, what's intriguing is even considering Eddie Albert, because 20 years later, he's Oliver Wendell Douglas in Green Acres. But the fact was, he was a pretty good actor. In fact, a very good actor. And some people thought he should be playing Lou because he had dimples like Gehrig. One of his big fans was Ed Barrow, the president of the Yankees. Barrow was a big, big fan of Eddie Albert's, and he was of the dimple class. He liked Eddie Albert's dimples. But I think he felt that I saw a couple of letters between he and Eleanor and between Barrow and Eddie Albert's agent. He was probably stepping out of his comfort zone by being an advocate like that. He basically said, well, I'm backing out. right now, soon after he backed in. But, you look at the press releases that went out and the coverage and the sporting news, either because they wanted to believe or because they, you know, were part of the stunt, they were really, really into it. And it's fun to watch it. But remember, it's 1941 when they're doing this. People perhaps were a little more gullible back then.
Cooper brought a much different physicality to the role. Of course, everybody would have. He was no iron horse. There's a scene where some of the gifts he receives are so heavy he couldn't pick them up. And in the movie, there really is no explanation, Richard, about the disease.
Yeah. I mean, I think what they were assuming something on the part of those who were going to see it, that he was dead. That they understood it was some sort of, if they understood anything, it was a neuromuscular, neurodegenerative disease. So I think, you know, having much more, and I'm just kind of putting myself in Samuel Goldwyn's brain, that he wanted to focus so much on the bravery that he didn't want to depress people by showing him on his deathbed or showing him falling down or, you know, even got him in a wheelchair, which would have had to have been a scene after the Luckiest Man speech. So just having him clutch that shoulder while he's wrestling with Eleanor, and also there's a scene right before he takes himself out of the game in his last game. You see him flexing his hands and fingers, and you sense that he can't really feel them, get grip the bat very well. And that's why he takes him out of the game. I think there was enormous subtlety in not showing him stumbling around. There is a CBS made a movie in the 50s, Garrick Story, and it's a perfectly awful movie, and you do see him falling down, just falling flat on his face. Because he's losing his balance. And in 78, there's a movie based on Eleanor's memoir, starring Blythe Danner and Edward Herman, and we do see Herman on his deathbed. We do see him struggling a little bit here and there, and we see him immobile on the bed as he dies. So, but, you know, the movie in the 50s was tremendously unsubtle. The movie in the 70s was subtle and tasteful. But I think in 42, I think they didn't. I don't think Goldwyn wanted to show Cooper playing a very debilitated Gary. I just think he wanted to highlight. He loved the speech. He saw the speech in on the newsreel. He wanted it to end there when Gehrig's condition was not terribly debilitated. He clearly had lost weight and muscle tone, and he didn't have the strength that he used to, which is why he couldn't hit anymore. But I don't think he wanted it to go very far beyond that.
And how amazing it is that Gary Cooper immortalized the speech, and that has become the de facto version of record, replacing Lou Gehrig's original. And you ask, has any other rendering of a historic speech ever become so closely identified with the actor? And also, it is really the standard by which all other speeches ever delivered in sports are measured by.
Yeah, but most of those speeches are basically retirement speeches. You're not the player you used to be. I remember when Mickey Mantle gave his speech, he invoked the Luckiest Man, but he was just washed up. He wasn't dying. So the circumstances of Gehrig's speech are so unusual. The closest one you can think of was Magic Johnson when he announced that he had the HIV virus. But he was combative even then, saying he was going to beat it. And it wasn't a great speech. It was a kind of a crisis speech. But Magic is such a positive person that he declared that, I think he basically said it's not going to kill him. And he was right. So, but with this, the circumstances, the venue, the personality of Gehrig, I mean, here's a guy who he knows he's ill, but he thanks everybody. He's lucky. Months later, I guess people were asking him, how could you say that? And he wrote a syndicated piece that basically said, whenever I achieved something as a kid, as a teenager, I felt lucky. And that was the note that he struck in his speech. And every other speech is compared to it, but none do compare. Nothing comes to that level of emotion, decency, and crisis, because really that it wasn't his last public appearance, but it was his swan song. It was his own funeral speech in a way.
In writing this book, what struck you about Lou Gehrig?
Oh, you know, nothing brilliant. Just, you know, the decency was there. I mean, I was focused far less on Gehrig than I was on the movie. So, you know, I was constantly struck by how much I was finding in the Samuel Goldwyn archives, you know, scripts and letters and correspondence. And maybe the key find was the notes of the interviews that Eleanor did with Paul Gallico as they started, as Gallico was preparing to start writing the screenplay. And here was Eleanor spilling her guts about her life with Lou and her life before Lou and her caustic opinions of Mother Gehrig, which found its way to some extent into the film. You know, I loved reading Eleanor's letters correcting the screenplay. She was really quite adamant. Again, she didn't win most of her battles, but it was clear that at least the screenwriters knew that somebody was looking over their shoulders.
Richard, great work, and I encourage everybody to pick up The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic for Hache Books. And we thank you, Richard, for being with us. So that'll do it for Richard Sandomir and myself on MLB.com. If you were on the move, thanks for the ride, and thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.